We spend a lot of time just looking at the surface of things. Like in material science or geology, we look at the facets of a crystal, right? Those perfect sharp edges of, say, a pyrite cube or a quartz prism, and we think we understand the order. It looks perfect, so it must be simple.
Yeah, that's the classic trap right there. The external shape, what we usually call the morphology, is really just the skin. It hints at the order underneath, but it doesn't actually tell you the rules of the game.
And that is exactly where we are going today. We are looking at those rules. We're doing a deep dive into chapter 4 of HKDH Padesha's Geometry of Crystals, Polycrystals, and Phase Transformations.
It's a fantastic
It
text.
really is. And fair warning to everyone listening, we are not just looking at pretty shapes today. We are looking at the mathematical DNA that dictates exactly where every single atom in the universe is allowed to sit.
The fundamental shift from just observation to actual prediction. That's the key here.
The topic today is space groups. And before we get into the really heavy stuff, like why steel gets harder when you squeeze it, or why diamonds are so fundamentally different from zinc sulfide, we need to address the elephant in the room, or rather the architecture of the room. Because we usually talk about point groups. What is the limitation there? Why isn't a point group enough to describe a whole crystal?
Well, think of a point group like a gym class where everyone is standing on a specific spot. You can spin around, you can look in a mirror, you can do a cartwheel, but your feet, the center of your gravity, they never leave that spot. Point groups deal entirely with symmetry around a fixed single point.
So there's no translation?
Exactly. No movement through space.
But crystals aren't just single points floating in a void. They are infinite lattices. They repeat.
Precisely. A crystal is a pattern that fills three-dimensional space. So to actually describe it, you can't just rely on rotation and reflection. You desperately need translation. You need to be able to pick up the pattern and move it to the next spot in the grid.
And that combination, taking the 32 simple point groups and mixing them with the 14 Bravais lattices, the grids, gives us these space groups.
Correct. And mathematically, when you combine them, there are exactly 230 of them.
That's it.
That's it. 230 distinct ways to tile the 3D universe.
That number always blows my mind a little bit. Not 229, not 231, just exactly 230.
It's elegant.
It is. But the text gets into the weeds almost immediately with how this movement actually happens. It's not just a simple slide to the left. It talks about screw axes and glide planes.
Right, because this is where the geometry gets truly dynamic. These are compound operations.
Let's start with the screw axis, because the notation in the book is something like a 2 sub 1 or a 4 sub 1 or a 6 sub 5. Now, to the uninitiated, that just looks like algebra gone wrong.
It does look intimidating.
But it's a very specific instruction set, isn't it?
It is. A screw axis is a rotation strictly coupled with a translation. It's a spiral motion.
So not just spinning a top in place.
No. Imagine a spiral staircase. That is probably the best physical analogy for this. To get from one step to the next, you have to rotate a certain number of degrees around the central pole, but you also have to step up at the same time.
Okay, so let's decode that syntax. If I see a 4 sub 1 screw axis in the text, the big number, the 4, that's the rotation part.
Right, a four-fold rotation. That means you take 360 degrees and divide it by four. So a 90-degree spin.
And the subscript 1.
That is the translation part, expressed as a fraction of the unit cell height. So 4 sub 1 literally means rotate 90 degrees, then move up one quarter of the way. If you do that four times 90 degrees, step a quarter, 90 degrees, step a quarter.
You end up back at the start rotationally, but exactly one full floor up.
Precisely. You have flawlessly recreated the lattice 0.1 unit cell higher.
Okay, that makes sense. But here is where the text got a little spicy for me. It started comparing things like a 6 sub 1 axis and a 6 sub 5 axis. They both involve a six-fold rotation, but the steps are different. 1/6 versus 5/6. Why does that distinction actually matter?
Chirality, handedness. This is a detail people so often miss when they first study this. A 6 sub 1 axis spirals up in a distinctly right-handed fashion. A 6 sub 5 axis spirals in a left-handed fashion.
Like a reverse thread.
Exactly.
Yeah,
It's the fundamental difference between a normal screw you'd buy from the hardware store and a reverse thread screw.
so even down at the atomic level, the handedness of the entire structure is dictated by this space group notation.
Absolutely. And that has massive implications if you're dealing with optical properties or especially biological interactions, where the exact shape and fit are everything. If a molecule has the wrong chirality, it won't bond.
Wow. Okay, so that's the screw operation, rotate and lift. Then we have the glide plane, which sounds very graceful, but it's really just a mirror with a sidestep.
That's a good way to put it. It is a reflection followed immediately by a translation.
Like footprints on a beach.
Yes, perfect analogy. If you look at your footprints in the sand, your left foot is a mirror image of your right foot, but you don't hop in place on one spot. You step forward, you reflect left to right, and then you translate forward. That combined motion is a glide.
And the book lists a few different flavors of this. You've got axial glides labeled A, B, or C, which slide right along the principal edges. You've got diagonal glides labeled N, which slide across the face.
Yeah.
But then there is the diamond glide labeled D.
The diamond glide is the tricky one to visualize. It involves a translation along a body diagonal, meaning cutting straight through the internal center of the cube, usually by a quarter step.
So one quarter, one quarter, one quarter in the XYZ directions.
Exactly. And that specific geometric operation is what gives diamond its totally unique structure, which we will get to later. But the main takeaway here is that space grooves aren't just static maps. They are sets of generative movements. They describe how the crystal literally builds itself in three dimensions.
Well, let's talk about that generation, because this was the part of the deep dive that actually made me laugh out loud. Section 2, dealing with cuprate, copper oxide, Cu2O. The text sets up this general position paradox.
Oh, it's a fantastic thought experiment.
So paint the picture for us. We have a unit cell for cuprate. The space group is PN3·m, which is quite a mouthful.
Let's break that down quickly so it's not just noise to you listening at home.
Mm-hmm.
The P means primitive, meaning lattice points are at the corners. The N is that diagonal glide we literally just mentioned. The 3-bar is a specific type of rotoinversion axis. And the M stands for a mirror plane.
Okay, so we have this theoretical box packed with mirrors, glides, and rotation axes everywhere. It's basically a fun house of mirror.
Correct. It is dense with symmetry.
Now, the text says, take a single copper atom and place it at a general position. Just some random arbitrary coordinate, X, Y, Z, not on a mirror, not on an axis, just floating in the space. What happens?
Chaos ensues. The symmetry operations of PN3·m are mandatory. They are absolute laws of that space. So the space group essentially looks at that single atom and says, okay, I have a mirror here, so I need a reflection of this atom over there, and I have a threefold axis over here, so I need three copies spun around this way, and then those new copies need to be reflected by the other mirrors.
It just cascades.
It's an exponential explosion. For this specific space group, putting just one atom in a general position forces the creation of 47 other identical atoms. You suddenly end up with 48 atoms in the cell.
48 atoms. But the chemical formula is Cu2O. We're supposed to have, what, two coppers and one oxygen? Or at least simple multiples of that basic ratio.
Exactly. A unit cell packed with 48 copper atoms would be impossibly, ridiculously dense. It wouldn't be cuprite. It would be a metallic nightmare.
So we have a major problem. The math of the space group demands 48 atoms. The chemistry of the material demands a very simple 2-to-1 ratio. Who wins?
They compromise. And this is where the concept of the special position comes in.
How does that actually work?
Imagine you are standing in a room with a mirrored wall. If you stand right in the middle of the room, you see your reflection as a completely separate person. That's two of you.
Right. I'm here. The reflection is there.
Now walk up to the mirror. Press your face right against the glass.
Okay, now I'm physically touching the reflection.
You and the reflection have merged. You now occupy the exact same point in space. By doing that, you have reduced the number of apparent people from 2 down to 1.
So nature puts the atoms directly on the mirror.
Exactly. By placing the copper atoms on specific high symmetry sites, like right on a rotation axis or right on a mirror plane, the symmetry operations map the atom directly onto itself. It doesn't generate a new copy somewhere else.
It effectively deletes the duplicates.
It reduces the multiplicity. In cuprate, the copper sits on a specific site with 3-meter symmetry. That mathematical placement cuts the required number from 48 all the way down to 4. The oxygen sits on an even higher symmetry site, 4·3 meters, which cuts the required number down to just 2.
So you get 4 coppers and 2 oxygens. That's a 2-to-1 ratio, Cu2O.
The math matches the chemistry perfectly. And this is the big insight from Badesia here. The crystal structure isn't just a passive container for the atoms. The space group dictates how many atoms are even allowed to exist in the box in the first place.
It's like a strict occupancy permit enforced by pure geometry.
That is a great way to put it.
Okay, so that's the structure existing in a happy, static state. But crystals don't just sit there in a vacuum. We use them. We stress them. Let's move to section 3, which focuses on cementite. Iron carbide, F3C. This is the stuff that makes steel hard, right?
It is the primary reinforcing phase in a lot of steels, yes.
Now, the text points out a really interesting paradox here. Cementite is orthorhombic, space group Panama. It's a complex rectangular box. But if you look at its shear modulus, basically, how springy or compliant it is, it's actually quite low. By all accounts, it should be soft.
Right. If you just look at the atomic bonds in their relaxed static state, it really shouldn't be that exceptionally strong. But in structural engineering practice, cementite is incredibly hard to break or deform.
So what is actually happening? The source spends some time talking about symmetry reduction.
This is where physics and geometry collide in a beautiful way. When you apply a huge mechanical stress to cementite, when you try to shear it or bend it, you distort that lattice. You squish the box out of shape.
And when you squish it, you inherently break the symmetry.
Correct. You forcefully push it from that orthorhombic Panama state into a lower symmetry monoclinic state, P2 sub 1 over C. You've physically lost some of your mirrors and rotation axes.
Okay, but why does losing symmetry make it harder? Intuitively, I would think breaking things makes them weaker.
Not in the realm of quantum mechanics. When the symmetry drops, the local environment for the electrons completely changes. The electrons involved in the iron and carbon bonds have to rapidly adapt to this new, distorted geometric shape.
They rehybridize.
Exactly. To maintain structural stability in this much less symmetrical state, the chemical bonding actually becomes significantly more covalent. It develops a highly directional 3D network of covalent bonds that simply wasn't as strong before the stress was applied.
So by trying to break it, you literally force the electrons to hold on tighter.
You induce strain stiffening. The material fights back by dynamically changing its fundamental bonding nature.
That is wild. It's like quantum jujitsu. And the text also mentions plastic deformation, permanent bending, slipping. This is where the sheer complexity of the space group really shows its teeth.
Right. For a solid metal to bend permanently without fracturing, you need dislocations, which are basically extra half planes of atoms to slip past each other, like sliding a heavy rug across a wooden floor.
But in cementite, the rug is really, really heavy.
The rug is heavy, and the floor is completely covered in obstacles. Because the unicell is so structurally complex, 12 irons, 4 carbons, all lock in very specific geometric spots, the Burgers vector is huge.
And the Burgers vector is the distance that dislocation has to jump to find a safe, stable spot, right? So it's not just a little hop to the next atom over. It's a long commute across a very complicated neighborhood.
And a long commute requires massive amounts of applied energy. Mm-hmm. That is exactly why cementite is so brittle and hard. The atoms would quite literally rather break their bonds entirely than try to make that massive jump. The complexity of the space group literally locks the geometry in place.
So complexity acts as a physical constraint, which brings us perfectly to the next fascinating comparison in the book. Section 4, The Broken Mirror, Diamond versus Zinc Sulfide.
Classic crystallographic showdown.
They look practically identical on paper. Both are cubic F lattices. Both have atoms sitting in roughly the same tetrahedrally coordinated spots. But diamond is space group FD 3 bar M, and zinc sulfide is F 4 bar 3 meter. Notice that little d is missing from the zinc sulfide notation.
The diamond glide is completely gone. Identity. In a perfect diamond crystal, every single atom is carbon. If I perform a diamond glide operation, meaning I reflect the structure and shift it by a quarter scuppock, my carbon atom lands perfectly on another carbon atom. The crystal looks identical before and after. The symmetry holds.
But zinc sulfide is made of zinc and sulfur.
Two entirely different actors. If I try to do that exact same reflect and shift move on a zinc atom, it might land directly on a spot that is supposed to be occupied by a sulfur atom.
And zinc is definitely not sulfur.
The symmetry operation fails fundamentally.
Right.
It's forbidden. The crystal simply cannot contain that symmetry element because the constituent atoms aren't interchangeable.
So the mirror is broken. Does this actually matter for the material, or is it just a pedantic labeling issue for crystallographers?
Oh, it matters immensely.
Mm-hmm.
Because zinc sulfide lacks that specific center of symmetry, what we call the inversion center. It develops polarity.
Piezoelectricity.
Exactly. If you squeeze a diamond, absolutely nothing electrical happens. It's perfectly symmetric, all the internal charges balance out. But if you mechanically squeeze zinc sulfide, because of that missing symmetry, the positive zinc centers and the negative sulfur centers of charge physically shift relative to each other. You literally create a measurable voltage.
That's incredible. Just by swapping one atom type out for another, you break the geometric symmetry code and suddenly unlock a superpower, like turning physical stress into electricity.
It perfectly illustrates that symmetry isn't just an abstract mathematical description. It is the absolute physical constraint that either permits or denies real-world properties.
Speaking of constraints, let's wrap up with the final section of the text, section 5. We've been talking about atoms moving inside a single crystal, but what happens when you try to grow a brand new crystal inside an old one? This is what Fedacia calls the precipitate problem.
Right. This is critically important for modern metallurgy. You heat up an alloy, and little distinct particles of a completely new phase start to nucleate and grow. Like, say, silver particles growing inside a solid block of aluminum.
The text clearly says the physical shape of those new particles isn't random at all. It is strictly decided by the intersection group.
Think of it exactly like a Venn diagram.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
You have the symmetry elements of the matrix, the aluminum host, that's one circle. You have the inherent symmetry of the precipitate, the silver guest, that's the other circle. The new particle is trying to grow precisely at the interface where these two distinct atomic lattices meet.
And they have to agree on the rules.
They absolutely do. The macroscopic shape of the growing particle can only possess the symmetry elements that are simultaneously present in both the matrix and the precipitate.
So if the aluminum host has a convenient fourfold rotation axis, but the silver precipitate doesn't...
Then the particle cannot possibly use that fourfold axis to define its external shape. It's strictly forbidden. The intersection group, denoted as H, the shared symmetry, dictates the final morphology.
It's like a strict diplomatic treaty. You can only execute actions that both countries explicitly agree on.
And that completely explains why certain precipitates form sharp needles or flat plates or perfect spheres. The surrounding matrix literally sculpts the guest particle by denying it growth directions that would violate their shared symmetry treaty.
Geometry dictating destiny. I think that really is the core theme of this entire chapter.
It definitely is. From the impossible atomic packing paradox in Tuprit to the strain-induced hardness of cementite down to the exact shape of silver precipitous, it's all just following the immutable mathematical rules of the space group.
So to bring this deep dive home for you listening, we started by asking how we get from the simple outside shape of a crystal to the complex inside map. And the answer is that the space group is so much more powerful than just a set of coordinates.
It is a rigid set of constraints. It dictates where atoms must go to maintain efficiency. It dictates how electrons must alter their bonds when stressed. And it fundamentally tells us why materials behave the way they do in the real world.
We talked about chirality and screw axes, how a left-handed twist at the atomic level is completely different from a right-handed one. We saw how symmetry reduction can actually make a material significantly stronger by forcing intense covalent bonding.
And we saw how breaking a simple mirror symmetry creates piezoelectricity out of nowhere.
So here's the final provocative thought I want to leave you with today. Towards the end, the text mentions a brief comparison between a disordered phase called gamma and an ordered phase called gamma prime. In that ordered phase, the Burger's vector, that necessary slip distance for deformation, literally doubles in length.
Which means it becomes twice as hard to move a dislocation. Because you can't just slide to the nearest adjacent spot. You have to physically slide past all the wrong neighbors just to find the right one again.
Complexity directly creates strength. So here is the question for you to mull over. If we can truly master these space groups, if we can understand these 230 specific codes perfectly, could we purposefully engineer a material where the internal symmetry is so insanely complex and the Burger's vector so impossibly long that the material simply cannot deform?
You mean a structural material where dislocation movement is literally forbidden by the underlying mathematics itself?
Exactly, a theoretically unbreakable material.
That is the ultimate dream of material science. We are already somewhat doing it with advanced superalloys and modern jet engines, but the ultimate limit, the limit is only defined by how well we can play this incredible game of 3D atomic chess.
3D chess with atoms. I absolutely love it. Thanks for unpacking all this heavy geometry with us.
It was my absolute pleasure.
And to all of you listening, next time you happen to pick up a rock or admire a gemstone, just remember, the real show isn't the shiny facets on the outside. It's the incredibly complex, invisible dance of symmetry happening right there on the inside. See you on the next deep dive.